food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Gentlemen, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. Our guest today is Michael Snyder from the economiccollapseblog.com. We'll get to Michael in a moment. First, here's the market reports. Gold is up 90 cents to $1,365.20 per ounce. Silver is up 18 cents to $23.25 per ounce. Platinum's down $2. To $14.78, palladium is down $2 to $697 per ounce. Dow Jones is up 113 points to 15,304. NASDAQ's down 7 points to 3,721. New York Stock Exchange up 18 to 9,638. U.S. Dollar Index is... where is it? Down 0.32 to 81.50. It's been hanging around the 81 to 82 range here for probably a week or more, and it just seems to more or less float in that range. Crude oil is up 29 cents to $107.68 per barrel. Michael Snyder has been on the program once before. He is the author... the master blogger behind the economiccollapseblog.com. That's the economiccollapseblog.com. Michael is got a Bachelor of Science in Commerce from the University of Virginia. He's got a law degree from the University of Florida. He's got an LLM from the University of Florida, deal with tax law. And he writes in his blog that he's way too, he says, I am way too overeducated. Hello, Michael, are you there?
I am here. It's a real pleasure to be back on with you again.
Yep, good to have you back. Do you really, I know you're joking, I assume you're joking when you say you're too overeducated. Is it possible to be too overeducated in this world right now?
Well, it's good to have real education, and most of what I've ever learned, I've learned on my own. But in terms of my formal education, I think, you know, I could have done with a bit less of that. And, you know, as someone who has been in the system for so many years, you know, in our education system, I've come to view it really as propaganda. They're really teaching you what the establishment wants you to know and how they want you to think. And so fortunately I was able to step back from that. But for so many people, they get immersed in that and they come out and they're, essentially drones for the establishment, spouting the belief systems of the establishment, and they never escape from that the rest of their lives.
You know, one of the things I've seen over the years, people have degrees in law. I'm curious, are you a practicing attorney right now? I see you have the degree. Do you actually practice law?
Not anymore. I used to. I used to be out in the Washington, D.C. area, but a few years ago we moved away, and now I'm living out here in Idaho, and I don't practice anymore. To a certain extent, though, being able to analyze things from a legal perspective and from the background that I got there and in some other education, helped me to understand how things work in the financial world and so forth, and so I try to apply that on my websites.
I had a friend years ago who had made a fortune in geology, but the reason his degree was in geology, and that's what he wanted, to do for a living, but he said that he recognized very quickly, once he got into the business, that the people who did well in that arena were the ones who also had degrees in law. So he went to law school nights. He worked his business during the day, and now he went to law school, and he got a degree in law, and he became a very wealthy man. So clearly it's a valuable degree, even though he never practiced law himself. It's valuable to understand what's going on. Point I was trying to make, though, I wanted to get to was, I've watched people go through law school, and they frequently have to take out loans in order to get through law school. And by the time they take out the loan to get through law school, and then if they're successful and they get themselves a decent job, first thing they do is they buy themselves a new car with car payments, and they get themselves a big house with mortgage payments, and all of a sudden they are trapped by their own debts in a way that they can't quit the business. And some would say they can't quit the racket without losing everything they've got. Their debt ties them down to the propaganda that you were talking about relative to education. I wondered if you'd seen anything similar and you agree with that analysis.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. In fact, I still have law school debt that I'm paying off after all this time. But it's very true. And, and you mentioned the successful ones, those that are able to get a good job. And, people think of lawyers, oh, they're doing so well. Mm-hmm. But that's only a small segment that get with a big firm in New York or Washington or whatever and make, a pretty good income. But most lawyers, actually, the average lawyer doesn't make that much money. They go to law school and they run up all of these debts. But when they get out, the big firms only recruit from the top 10%. If you're not in the top 10% of the class, then you're pretty much out of luck there unless you know someone or have some type of connections. But most law school graduates really struggle to even find any type of a job once they get out. Many end up working for $20,000, $30,000 a year if they're able to find work. And so, it's kind of a myth that when people think, oh, I'm going to go to law school and be successful, those that come out and actually make good money are only a relatively small percentage. So, people need to understand that about law school graduates.
In your blog, talking about yourself, you say you do not believe the world is about to end. In fact, you believe that the coming economic collapse is going to unfold over a number of years. So you don't see that we are going to experience a moment a year from now, a month from now, sometime where, oh my gosh, the dollar suddenly collapses, for example.
Well,
you see that we're going to kind of ease into this thing and...
Well, I am different from most of the other people who write about these things, where they kind of hype it up as some kind of big Hollywood event that's coming where there's going to be a moment, a week, a month, where everything just falls apart, and then it's all over, and then we can recover. Now, I have a different analysis from that. I kind of liken it as a series of waves. In 2008, we saw a wave. Now, that didn't destroy us. It took us down. We've never recovered even close to where we were, say, back in 2007. So we're damaged, we're hurt, and now I believe another wave is coming, and that wave will be, I believe, even worse than 2008. There will be great fear, great panic, chaos in the financial market, stock market crash, disaster, but that won't be the end. I believe it will damage us, and we'll never recover back to the level we are right now. but it will continue, and there'll be more waves after that subsequently. So, you know, I believe this is a process, and that there are a series of waves, and that there are moments of great panic and great chaos, but that it is playing out over a number of years. So that's my perspective on it, and it kind of differs from most of what you'll hear out there.
Well, the idea that we would have a sudden and catastrophic moment when the whole thing goes up, turns to chaos, it makes for good Hollywood drama. And it's the sort of thing that we can understand in our own minds. It's something that's easily, oh my gosh, the world all of a sudden came to an end, and we get it. We can see it. We can understand it. I saw an article, several years ago, where someone was talking about the Great Depression. And I'll bet you I saw this 10 years ago, matter of fact, when I think about it. And everyone thinks that the Great Depression started with a stock market crash in 1929. And all of a sudden, it's as if everything was wonderful, and they threw a light switch, and the next day after the stock market crash, everything was bleak. But what he pointed out is that as late as 1933, a significant percentage of the country still doubted that we were even in a depression. And the point was that even the Great Depression unfolded more or less as you've described. It's not one great catastrophic event. It is a difficult situation that just continues to grind down and down and down. Now, we went through the Great Depression and we came out of it. Difficult time, but we did come out of it, and we rose. We came back to prosperity. Do you expect that we will be able to restore prosperity, or are we facing losses that might be permanent?
Well, this is another area where I kind of differ from some people who write about these things. They see this collapse coming, but then they say, oh, but there's hope beyond it. The United States will recover. Unfortunately, I'm not that optimistic about the future of this country. You know, even now there are solutions that could help us in a lot of ways, but they're not even our politicians are not even willing to consider them or bring them into the debate. So the storm that's coming, I do not believe is going to be averted. I think we're going to go all the way down. We're going to go far, far below where we are today. It's going to be, you know, by the end of this thing, it is going to be disastrous. It is going to be absolutely nightmarish, breakdown of society. And I don't think we're ever going to get back to even the level we're sitting at right here today, much less where we were, you know, 10, you know, 20 years ago, whatever. So, and, you know, and there's a lot of reasons for that, you know, whether you want to talk about, you know, how we've accumulated the biggest debt bubble in the history of the world, or if you want to talk about how our economic infrastructure is being absolutely gutted, how jobs and businesses are being sent out of the country. We're not producing wealth here in this nation. You know, or about how our financial system is more vulnerable and more reckless than ever before. I think our financial system is going to, you know, completely implode. And considering our entire system is based on the flow of credit and debt, you know, I think that that entire thing is going to blow up. The house of cards is going to come down. And our financial system will never be the same that it is today.
You talk, well, you've got three subjects there in general that we can talk about. Let's start with the debt. The debt is too big to ever be repaid. I mean, that's a concept I've understood, and it was a memorable moment for me at least 5 years ago when I realized that it was too great to ever be repaid because the implications are enormous. One man's, largely because one man's debt is another man's asset. You wipe out the debt, you wipe out the assets also. And
It's very true. And a few years ago, I wrote an article which got a lot of attention about how, you know, I believed it was mathematically impossible to pay off the national debt. But it's not just the debt of the federal government that we need to be concerned about. You know, our state and local governments are drowning in debt. Our businesses are up to their eyeballs in debt. And then consumers, we've been on this unprecedented debt binge as consumers, which, you know, we've never seen before in U.S. history. And, you know, as a total, you go back 40 years ago, the total ball of wax, including all government debt, all corporate debt, all consumer debt, was about $2 trillion 40 years ago. Today it is more than $56 trillion. So over the past 40 years, our total ball of debt has gotten more than 28 times larger. It's the biggest mountain of debt in the history of the world. And, you know, the only way we can keep things going is for this debt spiral to spin faster and faster and get bigger and bigger. And when there's an interruption, and I believe we're starting to see that, you know, there's the danger of the whole thing seizing up, coming apart, and falling down in a massive implosion that doesn't have any precedent in American history.
We talk about an interruption, or you just talked, you mentioned an interruption. I'm not sure what you have in mind, but are you talking about a loss of creditors? In other words, people stop lending money to support this spiral of more and more debt. And we're seeing that. The only people that will substantially lend money to the government right now is the Federal Reserve.
Oh, it's very true. In fact, in the past few months, we've actually seen foreigners become net sellers of U.S. Treasuries. They're starting to get rid of U.S. government debt. We've seen bond yields rise. And as the bond yields rise, it's got a whole host of dangers. You know, the government has to pay more. It becomes more expensive for them to borrow money. But another huge danger, which I'm extremely concerned about, and I think in this next wave of financial crisis that's coming, I think is going to play a key role, is as bond yields rise, well, these big banks, these too big to fail banks, which are at the core of the flow of credit, money, debt in our system, they're the center, they're the core. You know, like we saw back in 2008, when credit starts freezing up on Wall Street, it affects all of us. It affects the entire society, the entire system. So these two big to fail banks, their health, at the time, U.S. Secretary of the Treasury Paulson was correct. The health of those financial institutions is actually absolutely imperative, because if they go down, if they fail, credit freezes up and then, you know, economic activity comes to a standstill because no one can get money. So these two big to fail banks, their health is absolutely imperative. The problem is they've been awesomely reckless, is one way to put it. They've been incredibly reckless in terms of making these incredible gambles. And one aspect of this is derivatives. And what these big banks have done, they've written trillions upon trillions of dollars of these derivatives. In fact, when it comes to interest rate derivatives, they've written more than $441 trillion of interest rate derivatives. And so, in essence, they're insurance contracts that they've written out to people that as protection against interest rates rising. Well, now interest rates are rising. You know, we've seen the yield on 10-year U.S. Treasuries now rise up to about 3%. If that keeps going, if that keeps rising, a lot of those interest rate derivative contracts are going to go bad for these too big to fail banks, and we could see a massive implosion, because when you're talking about $441 trillion, you're talking about an amount of money that is almost unimaginable.
I understand. You know? It is unimaginable. It is a fictional quantity of money. It can't be true in the sense that the world's gross domestic product is in the neighborhood of $70 trillion a year. And here we have mere interest rate derivatives that are $440 trillion. We're talking about, what, six times the gross domestic product of the world in interest rate derivatives alone. And one of the things is, where do you see the trigger point? We understand that if interest rates rise too much, we're going to trigger a default on the interest rates derivatives. Interest rates are up to 3%. Where is the trigger point where we begin to see the problem with the derivatives? Is it 4%, 5%, 10%? Do you have an idea?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've seen articles on CNBC where they talk about 3.5% starting an orderly rotation out of bonds, kind of panic selling. So some analysts on CNBC have talked about 3.5% being an important level. Personally, I think, you know, once we get up to 4% and then especially 5%, I would be extremely concerned. And, you know, a lot of people might think, well, 5%, what, you know, that's kind of far away. But, you know, those levels used to be considered normal back in the old days before the Federal Reserve started forcing interest rates down. And that's really
I'll tell you what, Michael, we're going to have to break and take some commercial announcements. I'm here with Michael Snyder from TheEconomicCollapseBlog.com. We will be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned.
Financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis, here on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Melody Cederstrom is there. She's not on the program today because she's shipping, involved in wrapping packages for all the good little boys and girls who've ordered gold. Melody was, I know there's a special for today, but Melody was going to send me an email, tell me what the special was, don't know. Give her a call. Find out what today's special is. I don't know right off the top of my head. I know she has one. I know she intended to let me know what it was. I don't know, so you're going to have to use your imagination or call Melody up, 1-800-375-4188. Find out what today's special was. Prices are always good. Specials are even better. Give her a call, 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is Michael Snyder. We are talking, among other things, about derivatives. And we were wondering about the interest rates, and we talked about what the trigger interest rate might be that would cause significant defaults in $440 trillion worth of interest rate derivatives, and these derivatives have to pay off if interest rates rise above a certain point. And the whole thing is a kind of madness. I've seen a few years ago, they estimated the total number of derivatives in the world to be about $1.4 quadrillion. More recently, it's been estimated that the total number of derivatives is somewhere in the neighborhood of $700 to $800 trillion. Where do you suppose was the original number, 1.4 quadrillion, was that simply a complete mistake? Or has the system managed to conceal or otherwise dispose of what would translate into something like $600 trillion in derivatives over the past several years?
No, I don't think so. I've seen different estimates, and the truth is that nobody seems to know what the exact number is. I've seen estimates from anywhere from 600 trillion all the way up to 1.4 quadrillion. Now, the number I quoted you earlier, about $441 trillion just in interest rate derivatives, that actually comes from the U.S. government, so that's a little bit more of an official figure. But, yeah, no one knows exactly what the real number is, but everyone agrees that it's absolutely massive, you know,
and it's beyond comprehension. It's beyond reality. I've become a student of derivatives, and I don't pretend to understand. I don't pretend to understand them. Certainly not clearly. But there's a great deal of confusion surrounding them, and it turns out maybe they're not as confusing as some people think. The definition I've read is that a derivative is essentially a financial instrument that has no intrinsic value, and therefore whatever value is attributed to that financial instrument is derived from something else. Now, if it's true that we've got $800 trillion in derivatives that have no intrinsic value, and their value is merely derivative from something else, what do we really have? What is the significance of an instrument that has no intrinsic value?
Yeah, it's just a house of cards. You know, in the old days when, you know, you went to invest in something, you invested in a stock, that's something real. You're getting equity in a company. If you're investing in a bond, you know, you're investing in the debt of that company. When you're investing in a derivative, you're essentially just, you know, betting either that something will happen or something that won't happen. You know, we remember these credit default swaps from the last financial crisis. Those were, you know, derivative type instruments as well, you know. And that's another huge issue that's here looming on the horizon that's related to these derivatives and to these too big to fail banks. We remember during the last financial crisis what the housing crash did to the too big to fail banks. It brought them to the brink of annihilation, of disaster, of being wiped out. Well, we're starting to see huge trouble signs in the housing market once again. Bank of America has just announced that they're getting rid of 2,100 mortgage-related jobs. Wells Fargo has announced that they're getting rid of 2,300 mortgage-related jobs. J.P. Morgan Chase is going to get, they're saying they're going to be getting rid of possibly 15,000 mortgage-related jobs. And why are they doing that? Well, what's happening, all these mortgage lenders are looking at the market and they're saying, hey, interest rates are going up. That means the refinance boom is over. In fact, just last week, mortgage refinance activity plunged to the lowest level that we have seen since June 2009, and total mortgage activity dropped to the lowest level since October 2008. And in fact, since early May, total mortgage mortgage refinance activity has dropped by 70% just since early May, and it's because of these rising interest rates. So, you know, people are not refinancing their mortgages anymore, and then, you know, not as many people are going out and getting mortgages because their rising interest rates are causing it to become more expensive to get these mortgages. And so the higher interest rates go, it's going to start forcing home prices down. Because the higher interest rates go, that means the higher potential mortgage payments go when you buy a home. So more home prices are going to have to come down, like we saw during the last financial crisis, in order to make up the difference so people can still afford these homes.
To what degree do home prices go down, and to what degree do home sellers, people that they own a home, they'd like to sell a home, are they going to be forced to finance it themselves? Are they going to be looking for cash buyers? I'm just saying, look, we can't get mortgages. We know I want to sell a house. I know no one can get a mortgage to buy the house. That means I'm going to have to sell at a price where someone can pay cash for this house.
Yeah, and that creates a problem, because when you're talking about, say, a $300,000 mortgage, you know, who can plop that down that amount of cash?
You know, yeah, it's the prices. The house is going to fall to $100,000 or less in order to make a cash sale.
Yeah, so, you know, it creates a problem, because most people, you know, there are cash buyers out there, certainly, but most people have to get a mortgage. And just, you know, so people have a rate of reference. You know, about a year ago, the average rate on a 30-year mortgage was sitting at 3.66%. And so the monthly payment on a 30-year mortgage for a $300,000 mortgage at that rate would be about $1,374. Now, all of a sudden, if you increase that rate up to 8%, the same payment on that same exact home would be $2,201.29. So we're talking about a potentially dramatic fundamental change, you know, in mortgage payments and what people would have to pay, on a monthly payment in order to buy a particular home. So this is going to have a fundamental impact on the housing industry. In fact, I'm working on an article right now where I'm telling people, hey, if your job has anything to do with real estate, building homes, buying homes, selling homes, or it's in any way related to mortgages, you might want to start searching for alternate employment, because everyone remembers what happened back in 2008, the devastation that it had in those fields for people working in those fields, you know, and how many people had to end up leaving those fields because of the devastation. Well, this little mini housing bubble that we've been enjoying is now ending, and we're heading into another period of time, I'm afraid, you know, when we're going to just see utter devastation in the housing industry.
All right. If we're going to see utter devastation in the housing industry, if that's where we're headed right now, what else will follow? How does this affect the banks, for example? Will the banks be able to get, will they be able to survive by laying off tens of thousands of people who've previously been involved in producing and selling mortgages? Will that be enough to protect the banks? Or is this going to have a more systemic effect?
Well, like we saw back in 2008, when housing prices go down and when, you know, people start losing their jobs and people can't make their mortgage payments and mortgage defaults go up and then banks aren't getting their payments. All of a sudden they've got these foreclosures on their hands. I mean, it's just devastating for financial institutions. So I think, you know, we're going to see more bank failures in the years ahead, you know, huge problems. In addition to all the other stuff I just talked about with derivatives, I think that, you know, as this next great financial crisis starts to unfold, I believe that we're going to see not just one, but multiple too-big-to-fail banks fail. And, you know, of course, there'll be calls for Congress to bail them out. I think Congress will be much more resistant to do that this time, and I think I think the coming crisis is going to be even worse than we saw the last time, because what should have happened last time is people should have realized, hey, our system, there's something wrong with our system. We need fundamental reforms. We need fundamental changes. These banks shouldn't be so reckless. But instead, they just kind of patched things up and then told the banks, okay, go ahead and do the same things you were doing before. We've kind of patched things together. And so that's what they've done. They've gone and continued to be incredibly reckless, do many of the same things as before. And so now we're headed for an even bigger problem.
If you had to identify one fundamental flaw, the Achilles heel, the fatal flaw in our system, what do you suppose it is?
Well, boil it down to one fundamental problem, I like to talk about the Federal Reserve, because it was the Federal Reserve that created the first housing bubble, which caused so much problems. And now the Federal Reserve has created, you know, these problems again by forcing interest rates down to record low levels, ridiculously low levels that didn't make any sense. And, of course, it was inevitable that interest rates would want to start reverting back to more normal levels, more free market levels at some point. Unfortunately, that adjustment is going to be immensely painful for the U.S. economy. And then the Federal Reserve, of course, is supposed to be regulating the too big to fail banks. But it's kind of like asking the fox to guard the hen house. You know, the Federal Reserve really is at the heart of so many of our problems. Unfortunately, they're not accountable to the American people. They're unelected. They're unaccountable. And they say, oh, we're independent. We don't want to politicize our decisions. You know, so the American people get a vote and have input, supposedly, in all these other areas of society. But when it comes to our money, our financial system, the economy, oh, the American people, they're not allowed to have a say. And it's horrible because the Federal Reserve is really a very, very insidious institution.
Is the problem the Federal Reserve, or is it fiat currency? Or can the two be separated? Can we even say one without saying the other?
Well, the problem is the Federal Reserve is a fiat currency system. And, you know, if you go back 100 years ago, you know, we're coming up on the 100th birthday of the Federal Reserve. And if you go back 100 years ago, you know, and you take a look at where we are then and where we are today, well, the value of the U.S. dollar has declined by more than 96%. Since the Federal Reserve was first created, you know, a dollar from back then only has about 4% of the purchasing power today. And yet the Federal Reserve continues to accelerate the destruction of our currency. And then we've seen our debt. You know, the Federal Reserve was designed by the bankers to be a debt creation machine to trap the U.S. government in a perpetual debt spiral from which there would never be any escape. And we've seen that. And today, the U.S. national debt, since the Federal Reserve was created, has gotten more than 5,000 times larger. But that was what it was designed to do, because these bankers, these financial institutions, they make money by getting governments and all the rest of us into debt. So they wanted the government in debt. It was designed to do that. So the Federal Reserve system was designed to destroy us. You know,
I agree.
We were always told that, oh, it's for our own good. The Federal Reserve is going to keep financial panics from happening. It's going to make things so much better for us. But if you actually go back and look at our history, the greatest period of economic growth in United States history was at a time when there was no Federal Reserve and no income tax. But then 1913 comes along and everything changes. And not only did we get the Federal Reserve in 1913, we also got the income tax, because they had to have an income tax, because the only way to pay for all this debt and everything else is big government, you know, that they started instituting in those days, is to take money from the American people. So it's no coincidence that we saw the Federal Reserve and the income tax both come in 1913.
I'd say another major component is big government, and partly because two economists published a report about a month or 6 weeks ago where their calculations indicated that if we had the same level of regulation today as we had in 1949, government regulation, that the median household income would be about $330,000. As compared to what it is $53,000. Their point is that the government regulation has cost us an enormous amount of prosperity. Now, you got to admit that government regulation may have also kept the air reasonably clean. It may have been good for the water, the environment. It's hard to say, but nevertheless, assuming these economists, and their numbers were serious, I won't say they're accurate. You know, I can't say it's God's truth, but there's got to be a point here. Government is also holding us down. We got big government, Federal Reserve, income taxes. For me, it's the, you know, the three horsemen of the apocalypse. They're taking this country to the bottom. You talked about low interest rates, amazingly low interest rates that made no sense essentially since 2008. They've been holding interest rates down. I'm curious, the express purpose for holding interest rates down was to stimulate the economy. At low interest rates, more people would borrow more money. I'm wondering if the purpose of low interest rates was to try to skirt the derivative problem of the interest rate derivatives. And I'll ask you to answer that question when we return in a moment. We've got a break for a commercial announcement. I'm Alfred Adask here on Financial Survival. I'm with Mike Snyder from TheEconomicCollapseBlog.com. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Countries have denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a KU band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Adask here on Financial Survival with our guest, Michael Snyder. Program is brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Melody has sent me an email. Tell me what the special du jour is. For the month of September, all completed trades in your name will be placed in a drawing for a chance to win an MS-62 $10 Liberty gold piece valued at over $900. And there will be a second prize, which is a tube of 20 one-ounce silver eagles. 20, what would that translate into? Ballpark figure, $500. So if you place an order today, tomorrow, you order this month, you'll get your name in the hopper, and come October 1st, we'll have a drawing, and the two names that are drawn out will receive the MS-62 $10 Liberty and or the 20 one-ounce silver eagles. Today's special, you're going to get Mint State 62 $10 Indian, Mint State 62 $5 Indian, 1 ounce gold buffalo, the modern issue coin, and a copy of Michael Snyder's book, The Beginning of the End. And total price, $3,000. This includes shipping and, again, a copy of Michael Snyder's book. Michael is our guest today. Give Melody Cedarstrom a call, 1-800-375-4188. When we broke for our commercial announcements, I was advancing a question and probably pretty clumsy. I'm not sure if you understood it, Michael. But did they hold interest rates down after 2008? Was the primary purpose to stimulate the economy and allegedly encourage people to borrow more money and go into debt and build a house or buy a new flat screen TV and stimulate the economy? Was that the purpose? That's what they pretty much claimed. Or was the real purpose to stay away from the interest rate derivatives? You follow my question?
Well, I do follow your question, and I do believe that at the time, you know, there was so much concern about the economy that they did want to try to help the economy. So the Federal Reserve tried to press interest rates super low, and they did get them to record low levels. The Federal Reserve started printing tens of billions of dollars out of thin air. You know, the federal government went on this unprecedented debt binge, running trillion-dollar deficits a year. And, you know, what they did is they kind of propped things up and stabilized things somewhat, and I guess we should be thankful that we got to experience a stabilized economy for a few years there. But, you know, in the process, they made our longer-term problems much, much worse. And at some point, it was inevitable that the interest rates were going to start to go up because it doesn't make any sense for them to be so incredibly low. And we've kind of painted ourselves in a corner now. We've got so much debt in our system, in our society, and the only way that the game can continue and that we can continue to live far, far, far above our means is for interest rates to be ultra, ultra low. If they go up, it's going to be absolutely catastrophic. Now, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, we could handle it because our system was not so weak. We had not painted ourselves to this corner, but now we've put ourselves into this corner, and particularly the big banks, because over the last few years, the big banks kind of got lulled into, you know, false sense of security, thinking, oh, interest rates will never go back up. The Federal Reserve will keep control. They'll be like pro-interest rates and keep them low. We can write all these contracts, all these derivatives for people, and all these insurance policies that, you know, against interest rates going up, because they'll always stay low because the Federal Reserve will keep them low. Well, the problem is the Federal Reserve is starting to lose control. You know, and foreigners are saying, hey, we don't want to buy U.S. debt. You know, they're starting to back off, and that could get a lot worse if we go to war with Syria and make the rest of the world very, very angry, and then the rest of the world could really start dumping our debt, and that would be a whole nother ball of wax. But the only way the game continues is with ultra-low interest rates. That's why, you know, if people want to know what's going on with the economy or how late in the game is, watch interest rates, you know, the rise in interest. And I think we talked about this on last time I was on, too. And now they're sitting at the yield on 10-year U.S. Treasuries is sitting at around 3%. You know, that's a number I check every single day because that is really going to tell the story, I believe, over the next 6 months to a year of what's going to be happening to us.
See, I don't necessarily agree that the only way we can hold this together is low interest rates, because low interest rates are great for borrowers. We get to pay off our debt, especially if there's inflation. You absolutely get to pay off your debt with cheaper dollars in the future. That's great for borrowers. But it's terrible for creditors. And when we lower interest rates, there was a time when the government and the Federal Reserve could afford to lower interest rates because we had a gold or silver-based currency, and it was pretty much trapped in the United States by virtue of the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. You couldn't move your money offshore easily. You had to run a certain risk. If you put your box of gold on a ship and the ship sinks, and you're in big trouble. The currency was trapped, and therefore creditors had to take whatever interest rate the government allowed. But today, with a digital currency and with the internet, creditors can move their money around the world at the speed of light. And if we hold a low interest rate, that might be great for borrowers, but it's so bad that the creditors expatriate their money. They move it to other countries and invest it where they can get more reasonable rates of return. And the net result is we are, with low interest rates, we may be diminishing the supply of money in this country. Now, I know it's been offset by $85 billion a month coming from the Federal Reserve, but do you follow what I'm saying?
Oh, and I totally agree with you. And for a long time, I've been amazed as creditors have continued out money at such low interest rates because they really have been irrational. It's not been rational to lend the U.S. government at money, less than 2% for 10 years. That's insane to do that. You're losing money that way. But foreigners have been pouring in, lending money to the U.S. government at that rate, other investors, and give a mortgage for a bank to give a mortgage to someone at, 3.5%. That was insane for 30 years. But banks, for a long time, creditors willingly engaged in this game, I think foolishly. Now they're starting to wake up and demand, a higher return. And it was inevitable that free market forces would want to push interest rates up to where they should be. The problem is if they do go up, economic activity is just going to be absolutely hammered because of this bubble that the Federal Reserve has created. So, there's no good way out of this thing. And you're right, it's been horrible for creditors, and interest rates are, it was inevitable that they were going to go back up to a more rational level. But this is going to, because of the corner we painted ourselves into, it's just going to absolutely crush economic activity. It's going to crush consumers, and then it's also going to crush our too-big-to-fail banks because of their recklessness.
You mentioned earlier, you talked about foreign countries were selling U.S. bonds. And I was wondering if that, do you suppose that Obama's attempt to attack Syria, could that be motivated by a desire to try to shore up United States bonds or foreign creditors? Is there any way that can be related, or are they completely, completely separate concepts?
Well, in my opinion, if Obama wanted to help our financial situation, he shouldn't be attacking Syria because, who are we going to upset if we attack Syria? Well, we're going to upset China and Russia, and collectively, they own more than a quarter of our foreign-owned debt. Today, foreigners own about $5.6 trillion of our debt, and Russia and China account for more than a quarter of that. And so if we really make Russia and China mad and they start dumping our debt, bond yields would go through the roof, and we could, so many people have written about what happens if China starts massively dumping our debt. So if Obama should think very carefully, because do we really want to anger all of the people who are paying our bills by going into Syria? Because that's what's going to happen, because most of the rest of the world is not on board with this attack on Syria. And if we go ahead and do it anyway and kind of just spite the rest of the world, they might not pay our bills anymore, and then we're in big trouble.
Well, we're in big trouble. We are in one of those darned if we do and darned if we don't situations, the rock and the hard place. There's no way out of this that I'm able to see other than to take our medicine. We have been, in my opinion, operating a financial system built on a fundamental flaw, fiat currency. The thing, it's a lie. We have built a grand structure, but that structure, that lie is being exposed. The structure is coming down, and I don't think it can be held together permanently. The question then is, when do we begin to see a more serious decline in our standard of living in our economy? I mean, everyone who looks at this can pretty much see, if they care to admit it, what's likely to come. But who knows when it's going to get here? When do we get the bad news?
Yeah, well, as you alluded to, every fiat currency system in the history of the world has eventually collapsed. And so ours is inevitably going to collapse as well. Now, they've tried to delay things, but, No, people didn't expect quantitative easing. That was unheard of. That's a crazy emergency measure, desperate attempt, but the Federal Reserve decided to go ahead and do that. And then, they had QE2, QE3, and so they've been able to delay it for a little bit. The federal government borrowing $1 trillion every year, that delays the pain a little bit. So they've been able to push it down the road a little bit. And it's kind of given people this false sense of security that, oh, maybe things are fixed. Everything's going to be okay, you know. But no, everything's not okay. These short-term temporary, quote-unquote, fixes they put have made our long-term problems much, much worse. So in the short term, they helped us out a little bit. Long term, really bad. So exactly when is it going to happen? It's hard to say because there's thousands of moving parts, and, you know, the politicians, the Federal Reserve, are always trying to delay the pain if they can. But at some point, time is going to run out, and it's going to be nightmarish. It's going to be much worse than most people could possibly imagine in the long run.
How soon could we see the bad news, and what is the latest that they? How long can this system be sustained until we absolutely must see the bad news? In other words, what's the range? Is it going to happen in the next month, the next year, 5 years from now? What's the range that you think is reasonable?
Well, I believe that the next major wave that I was talking about earlier of the financial crisis is going to strike by the end of 2015. I mean, it could come as soon as this fall, you know, so, you know, sometime, you know, we're looking at kind of a two-year window, I believe, for this next major financial crisis, this next major wave that's going to happen. But that's not going to be the end, of course, and that's one of the reasons why I entitled my book, The Beginning of the End. Because one of the things I wanted to communicate to people is that this isn't the end. This is just the beginning of the end. It's going to play out over time.
What do you recommend to, what can folks do to protect themselves against the coming debacle?
Well, of course, you know, one thing I love is gold and silver. It's something my wife and I personally, we believe in and we're doing is, you know, don't put your money in the stocks or bonds or paper, this or that. But, you know, physical gold and silver is a great way to protect your wealth through the crisis that's going to come ahead. Now, in the short term, there's going to be wild fluctuations in price of gold and silver. I've been saying that for a long time, and we've seen that. But in the long run, you know, that's where you want to be. You know,
Short term, you're implying that you think the price of gold could go up dramatically. It could also go down dramatically. Is that correct?
Yeah, and we've seen that. We've seen gold and silver. We've seen times that when they've fallen substantially in a short period of time, we've seen huge rises as well. And I think that we're going to continue to see that. But over the long term, I think the gold and silver, particularly I love silver, are going to go far, far higher than they are today.
What do you mean by long term? Are we talking about 10 years, 20 years, or are we talking about 3 years? What do you mean by long term?
Well, I believe by the end of this decade that we could very likely see triple-digit silver, $100 silver, by the end of the decade. You know, so
okay.
That's kind of what I'm talking about. But people have got to be able to handle the ride and not panic if, you know, they see things go down by a couple dollars here or whatever, because it is going to be a wild ride, I believe.
But you think even the idea that we would last for another decade or to the end of this decade strikes me as optimistic. I'm inclined to see we're going to hit the fan here a little quicker than the end of the decade, in my opinion, but who knows? I want to thank you for being on the program, Michael. Michael Snyder is the author of the economiccollapseblog.com. I encourage you to visit his blog. He's got some great material. He's prolific. He has article after article after article. Thank you for being on the program. Thank you, folks, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. I'll be back with Melody Cedarstrom. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Michael, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. There never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.